Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Is the era of video podcasts at hand? Pod TV believes so, and this programming venture is getting through on Roku and other smart TV products. Chief Executive Jeff White joins me next. Our next half hour revisits Cold Justice, the Dick Wolf overseen crime investigation series now playing on Oxygen. We'll spend time with executive producers Ashley Grebo-Sell and Scott Patch. And for our final 30 minutes, preview Icon, Music Through the Lens, a new PBS miniseries starting Friday with producer-director Dick Carruthers. Also ahead, the 2021 Primetime Emmy host and our classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. I present on Amazon Music, Verbal, the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, and Apple Podcasts. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. A very happy Monday afternoon to you, and welcome to the first of three episodes this week of the program about TV's current and future. 82 degrees at the top of the hour. Some wonderful guests coming away all week long starting today. We have a 90-minute episode for you, and we invite you, as always, to be interactive with our guests. It's very simple. Pick up the phone and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anywhere you are catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio. Shy about the phone? No problem. Use our chat room. It's up and running for you, and it's at SimonApple04 by name, and you'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the promo is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn screen. Follow those instructions, and other people will be live with you. Jeff White of Pod TV, live with us from Philadelphia, after these news notes. The Primetime Emmy Awards are set with a host for this year's presentation. That host is Cedric the Entertainer, co-star of CBS sitcom The Neighborhood. CBS will carry the Emmy Awards September 19th from the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles, with only nominees and their invited guests watching in person. That is up from nobody watching in person a year ago. Paramount Plus will simulcast the event. The Primetime nominations will be announced tomorrow. Also, Raven Simone and Lornie Love will host a pair of virtual daytime Emmy ceremonies for children's and lifestyle content this weekend. Both events will be distributed through smart TV sets and devices to viewers. Time now for quickies. You can expect the second season of Power Book 3, Raising Kanan, on Stars. The first season premieres Sunday night. Pluto TV will convert Pro Bowl Writing's Ride Pass channel from subscription to ad-supported July 20th. Ride Pass started in 2018, priced at $7.99 per month. Redbox will expand its free live TV bundle beyond 100 channels later this month. HBO Max has July 29th set to launch new unscripted dating series, Step Boy as F-Boy Island. Nikki Glaser is the host. Breaking news, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul creator producer Vince Gilligan will continue with Sony Pictures Television through 2025. Gilligan has at least one new series at Sony under development. And Jennifer Lopez will collaborate with Skydance Media on adapting a classic Broadway musical into a TV series or made-for-TV movie. And that is news notes for today. And now joining us live from Philadelphia in an interradio exclusive, the founder and chief executive of Pod TV, Jeff White. Jeff, good to have you aboard.
Hello, Simon. How are you today?
Very, very fine, thank you. So, first of all, define a video podcast, and where are we at in its development compared to podcasts?
Sure. So, video podcasting, very simply, sometimes you hear the term vodcast as well. It's just a video version of a podcast that's already been created and programmed. So it allows the, in this case, viewer to view and watch the same show that they're able to listen to in a traditional podcast environment.
Does it work the same way as a simulcast of a radio program? Like, for example, the radio shows that ESPN presents on ESPN Radio and then simulcast on television on ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Plus, and so on.
Yes, it can. In our case, it can. It works in two ways. One is in a pre-recorded mode, which is what most podcasting is, how it's done today. But it can be done live as well and then streamed out in both formats, audio and video. We have that capability within our network and platform.
So how did you come up, Jeff, with the idea for Pod TV?
Well, It's actually last year. My partner, Brandon Blackburn, and I were in the middle of we've been producing a few podcast shows in the audio format. We were looking at some additional shows in the audio format that had a real path towards television and film. And we noticed with some of the podcasts that we had brought to market that the audience that we put it on YouTube, really, quite honestly, to serve the needs of the one podcast in particular that thought they might have a bigger audience on YouTube. And we wanted to test the premise. And as it turned out, they ended up being much more successful on a long-form 45-minute podcast on YouTube from a viewership perspective than they were on the audio version. And that got us interested and intrigued. And, gee, this seems like an abnormal occurrence, or is it not? And we started quickly realizing, doing our research and homework, that there was a real need and desire for certain types of podcast formatting and shows in the video format. So really, it was about not so much looking at video and starting with video, but think of starting with an audio program where you could enjoy and engage the show fully through its audio format, but also could be enhanced through video, whether it be for a moment of time during that show or whether it be during the whole program length of the show, where, again, the video just enhances the show. As we went out to market, we started doing further research, and we went to three main constituents. We went to podcasters, we went to advertisers, and we went to fellow OTT platform providers and said, hey, is this something that makes sense, of interest? Tell us why this typical entrepreneur is right to want to find out why it's not going to work, right? And what we got was actually somewhat surprising, the support level of support we got and enthusiasm for it. Not that we didn't think it was a good idea, but as you know, many times you'll find some naysayers early on who talk about either someone else who's done it or why that format doesn't work and why you'll never find an audience. But in all cases, we got a super strong positive response. Veggie, it makes a lot of sense. Someone's going to do it well. We're surprised no one's really done that yet in a curated fashion, right? So we're actually curating, selecting shows, bundling them up in particular genres and categories, and then making sure we have a really first-rate presentation to the end user and the audience out there that likes a particular genre or a particular type of show.
Over the last 5 years, Jeff, we have seen how podcasts have become an art form unto themselves. In the case of unscripted shows, the use of audio clips, historical information, interviews, both live and on tape, and, of course, the whole scripted side of things, where you can have special effects and all sorts of other things you can use to enhance the audio presentation. What are you learning about what it takes to make a video podcast work in terms of what you have to do to make it visually appealing to people?
Well, first and foremost, what matters most is the authenticity of the show itself. We select shows that already have a proven audience, so we know that the content has real interest, right, in the marketplace. So there's the speculation around that is somewhat removed. And really, it's about the authenticity of the show. You've heard the old phrase in radio, boy, you've got a face for radio, right? Well, in the case of podcasting, the listeners really want to see and engage that individual who they listen to on a weekly or daily basis, right? And they want to be able to actually see them and visualize who they are, what their expressions are like when they're doing interviews or when they're discussing and talking with others about whatever the subject matter is. So kind of contrary to maybe conventional wisdom where you would think, oh, the higher produced video production capabilities would really enhance the show, although that can be the case in some circumstances. In the case of podcasting, that's really not the situation. People really are very, very comfortable, and they want that kind of gritty authenticity. Now, there are things you definitely can do that enhance the video capabilities or the show's capabilities through video production. And so some of those key learnings are making sure that your background, if it's a talk show format, that you have something that's pleasing to the eye, right, that's not distracting, making sure that the quality is – as high as it possibly can be. So in our case, we like to try to bring everything in at a minimum of 1K and in many cases 4K resolution, right? Because this is what users expect now just in any kind of video consumption. So those are a couple of the kind of the base level things. When we start doing things that are a little bit more towards the fully produced maybe storyline shows where it's an anthology series or something of that nature, then the video quality does matter, right? But you have to never overshadow the video with the audio. The audio has to tell the story. And one question we get asked often is, well, where's the line between a TV show, whether scripted or reality or conversational talk show, sports show, like you reference ESPN, and what you do? Isn't it kind of becoming the same? And our answer is no. The way our shows are selected and curated, in some cases developed on our end, is it's got to be able to stand on its own in the audio world. So you can enjoy and engage in it through the audio version, and the video, again, just enhances it. So, you know, I know maybe that's not as sophisticated of an answer as maybe you were expecting, but it's really just some of those simple things right now that make a difference.
Pod TV, the Video Podcast Network, is topic one this Monday afternoon on Tomorrow Be Televised. And joining us to talk about it is the founder and chief executive of Pod TV, running on smart TV sets and smart TV devices, Jeff White. He joins us in Philadelphia this half hour on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. I'm happy you're joining us too. Simon Abbaum up the coast from Philly here in New York, where it's 82 degrees and nice and bright at the top of the hour, kicking this week off. And if you have a question or comment, make the phone go 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We'll have another episode for you, one where sports is the big topic on Wednesday's show. That's less than 48 hours from now. And next week, Peacock finally does what it's wanted to do for over a year since its launch, and that is present live coverage of the Summer Olympic Games from Tokyo, Japan. And they'll do it in some very interesting ways. One of them is a live five-hour program called Tokyo Live. You'll meet the anchor person for that program, Matt Isman. He will be our lead guest. And we'll discuss all sorts of sports television topics, maybe some Emmy Award predictions. Emmys, of course, come out tomorrow morning. We'll speak with one of my favorite columnists covering the sports scene, the popular one from the Queen's Chronicle, Lloyd Carroll. That's Lloyd Carroll from the Queen's Chronicle and Matt Isman from Peacock's Tokyo Live. They'll both be with us on Wednesday. That's Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here, exclusively on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. Right now, Jeff, how many people can get Pod TV, and where can they get it when it comes to smart TV sets and devices?
Well, it's available now on any Apple iOS device that you have, whether it be a phone or a tablet, any Android device, again, phone or tablet, anywhere globally. It's also available on a multitude of OTT television apps, including TCL smart televisions, Roku, Android TV, Google Play, as well as PlayStation. And soon, in the next quarter or two, you'll see us on a few additional large TV manufacturers as an app and as a live broadcast channel.
And what are some of the live podcasts or taped video podcasts that people can see?
We have a wide range of genres and shows. We have talk shows such as Jordan Harbinger's, is very popular, kind of a top 10 or 20 show across the country right now in the audio format. We have shows in the criminal and true crime area, such as Dog in the Yard and Gangster Chronicles. We have shows from overseas in the UK, such as Trigonometry and Sean Atwood's True Crime. We have genres that are in the finance and kind of self-help education areas, such as Young and Profiting. So we really cover a gambit of types of shows, categories, and genres today.
You talked a little bit about this before the break, but say more about this. What's the criteria that you use with your production team as to what video podcasts you take?
Great question. So the first thing we look at is if the show is already in either audio or video format, what the audience looks like. And when I say looks like, kind of getting a picture of the metrics surrounding the audience for that particular show. So how many listeners or viewers do they have in total? How many subscribers? What's the average per show viewing or listen rate? What kind of social reach do they have? What's obviously, again, what the genre is, so it fits the ones that we're targeting. We're not trying to be all things to all people. You're not going to find a million shows on our platform, as there are in the podcasting world today. You know, we're looking at maybe a few hundred. Right now we have about 35 shows in our lineup, and literally adding them on a daily and weekly basis. Additionally, we also look for a podcaster that's excited about this. And the reason why that's important is because most of the podcasters that are out there today, and even the biggest and most successful ones, are independent. And this is a big part of what they do for their career. It's not necessarily a hobby, right, or a side gig. So them being very committed, enthusiastic, and passionate about not only their show that they have today, but coming onto our platform and helping propagate that by getting the word out to their listeners and viewers about where you can find their show now in a video format. Many of these shows may already reside on YouTube, and YouTube's a great platform. It's probably one of the most important platforms for creators to come along in the last 50 years because it really helped democratize the creator economy. But as you may know, there's 7.5 billion different pieces of content on YouTube, and there's hundreds of millions of shows. So it's very hard to get discovered there and stand out. So we think our platform is a way, an additive way for that producer to come to a place where we use a term called white glove with our podcasters. So if we're going to treat you with white gloves and it's going to be like a Four Seasons experience, right, then we want to make sure that the podcaster is excited about working with us and helping brand them and put them out there and build their show and build their network and sharing success with us.
When the coronavirus pandemic hit last year, a lot of different types of shows, including simulcasts, went to Zoom so that they could continue to operate live on the air or to do remote segments. Is that the same thing with video podcasts where you use Zoom and other remote techniques to bring guests in or bring panelists or moderators in or hosts in?
Yes, it has remained. I think it's become an artifact, like you said, from COVID, and there are some shows that still are using that technique, but you can't replace face-to-face. And wherever possible, we are trying to get back to that. It's not just about the quality of the video and the audio, but there's something about being in the presence of somebody else, especially if it's more than one individual, that you just can't replicate. And when you're talking about putting it in video format where someone can see it, it becomes noticeable. That being said, the advances in remote video podcasting have come quite a long way, and there are several platforms out there that have really perfected the ability for the podcast world and the creators to create those shows, merge in multiple individuals from across the globe at one time and have it look very seamless. As you know, many of the TV networks were doing the same thing, right? It wasn't just podcasting. It was the CNNs and ESPNs and Foxes of the world that were going to this capability out of necessity. Otherwise, they wouldn't have anything to broadcast. And quickly, they realized how they could use it effectively and not lose viewership, and in many cases, increase viewership, because now you can actually bring more people into the fray, where prior to that, it was probably used as a one-off, mainly in the news and sports area, where they're trying to bring someone in remote because of a live event that might have just occurred, right? Now it's become very commonplace. So we see both working and existing going forward. We don't think the remote capabilities go away at all, because it just extends the ability to bring in valuable and authentic content from all corners of the world. But again, having people face-to-face in a studio together creates an environment that isn't replicated yet in the world of remote video broadcasting.
You're hearing Jeff White. He is the founder and the chief executive officer of Pod TV, the video podcast network running on smart TV sets and smart TV devices, other places as well. And he joins us this half hour from Philadelphia here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Sound been with you live from New York. We're just getting started with our 90-minute episode today, and first of three episodes we're doing this week. If you have a question or comment for Jeff in our remaining moments with him, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Whatever you do, don't miss the first half hour of our episode on Friday, because we're going to showcase a very exciting development for a company we have talked about before on this program, twice. It's an interesting development that could really blow open the world of interactive television. And that's not all. The company that is making this situation happen, we expect the situation to break, incidentally, sometime on Thursday, has hired someone as an advisor who happens to be one of the top program executives in television. And we'll have an executive on the air with us. So be with us on Friday for a very special and very interactive, I hope, episode of Tomorrow Be Televised, 3 p.m. Eastern and Pacific this Friday right here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. I promise you it will be worth the listening. Jeff, how do you support Pod TV? Is it subscription? Is it ad revenue? And how are you doing on either count?
It's all ad-based revenue right now, Simon. So that includes FAST, AVOD, as well as TVOD. So we are recruiting in advertisers to support our network in multiple formats. So it could be direct insertion with video ads. It could be host read ads. Also, we run that across our library of content, so not just on our live channel, but across our library of content, as well as single events, which is, you know, the TVOD approach, which is a transactional video on demand. Sometime in the future, I think we see a place for SVOD, you know, for the subscription base in our world, but not initially. We think the upside, a couple things. One, the upside in FAST and AVOD is still untapped, especially when you look at the world of podcasting and the world of streaming OTT. Those are the two fastest growing medium platforms there are today. And neither one of them seem to be slowing down that much. And where you see the combination of these two, I think, really is because of the ad tech and the technical capabilities that exist and keep evolving so rapidly to continue to let it grow. Subscription, our belief is that subscription has a place as well for certain types of content. One of the things, though, in our research, we noticed that many of the podcast zealots were getting fatigued with subscription services, not so much in the audio side, podcasting world, but they tend to have a huge overlap in the streaming world. So when you look at the population of people that engage and listen to podcasts on a weekly basis, somewhere in the high 80s to low 90%, depending on the studies you look at, those same people are kind of the cord cutters and the streamers. And they weren't necessarily excited about having to pay another $5 or $10 a month for yet another platform. So we really believe that, if you will, our Trojan horses, our live channel, and our along with our FAST capabilities, in our video library, right? But we do see a place for higher curated and produced content that could sit in a subscription basis where it's warranted.
Yeah. Are you finding that there are certain advertisers or certain categories of advertisers who are more leaning into the service you're doing?
Yes, there are. It turns out, and it's not by the traditional means that you may segment out advertisers, kind of from like a brand or direct response perspective, you know, or B2B versus consumer. It's actually the brands out there that have probably touched many and multiple types of media formats and are looking for something new and different. So you can imagine the advertiser who spends a disproportionate of their money and time in the online video world through video ad insertion, and how they are intrigued and interested in a host read ad where the host of a show really embraces and engages with the brand. And as we know through podcasts, that becomes the most effective way to communicate a brand or a product out to somebody. Well, they can do that in the audio format. Imagine doing that now in the video format, right? So it's really a new type of ad capability for some of the brands that are out there today. So those are the ones. So it's really the ones, if I had to categorize, I'd say it's the ones that are more innovative, more leaning in, that want to try, that set aside budget for new and different things. That being said, traditional ad insertion works as well on our platform as it does on any other digital video streaming platform you have out there. So we're seeing anyone that's looking for that type of inventory coming in. And then the other ones where people were seeing is some on the sponsorship side. Because of our format and our ability to work very closely with the creators, we're able to do things in the show that are tend to be much more difficult to do in traditional, I'll call it, kind of network television world, right? And what I'm referring to is things as like in-show sponsorships. So a show like America's Got Talent or The Voice or even maybe a sports show would be able to integrate into their set and into their environment some kind of product or branding. That takes a lot of time, effort, and money. In our world, we're able to bring those same kind of capabilities to the advertiser to reach the audience in a very similar way, in a very authentic way, but at a much lower price point because we don't have as many layers between us and the actual creators and the talent. So it's myself and our staff dealing directly with the talent on the show, if that makes sense. That's the way the podcast world tends to work. There's not a lot of agents and corporate people and decision makers and all, we have to get approvals. You go right to the talent and say, here's the product, here's what they're interested in, how would you like to do this very unique format and monetize from it? And so we also can get very quick answers. Well, you know, the best thing to getting the answer, after getting an answer yes, the next thing is a quick no. So you know, I'm not interested in that. So we're able to really create something very unique between our platform and the multiple types of what I'll call ad units we have available. We're not just one size fits all.
Yeah. We have about a minute or two left, Jeff. At some point, do you expect to not only acquire or collect podcasts for the channel, for your service, but also commission podcasts, not only unscripted, but scripted? And do you see that in your sites?
Yes. Yes. I think our model is I would say, much more like in the television world, much more like a Hulu than a Netflix, where a Netflix maybe now an Amazon and others, right, they're building up their library on all original content, where Hulu has a blend of, hey, I'm going to recruit in and license in other proven shows, right, and also produce some of my own. So we really fall, I think, more in that strategic direction, where we're going to be producing incremental shows ourselves, bring them in, as you said, licensing. 10 years ago, who would have thought HGTV or the Cooking Channel would exist, never mind have the level of success that they've achieved, right? So it's a similar approach where they started nothing but aggregating. Next thing you know, they're producing because, you know, they see the appetite for this.
Again, the name of the service is PodTV, the video podcast network. It's available on Roku, on other smart TV sets, and smart TV devices. And more details about the service online, here's where you go, podtv.live. That's podtv.live. PodTV, the video podcast network, now on Roku, other smart TV sets and smart TV devices, and others coming aboard in the near future. Jeff Weiss, the founder and chief executive of PodTV, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on what you've done so far with the service, and hopefully much, much more success and original content to come.
Thanks, Simon. Appreciate it being on the show today.
Same here, Jeff. Take care. Enjoy the week.
You too.
Jeff White, founder and chief executive of PodTV, joining us live from Philadelphia. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll revisit a show we have talked about before on this program, the Dick Wolf Overseen series that started on TNT, now on Oxygen, Cold Justice. We'll have executive producers Ashley, Graybo, Stell, and Scott Patch will join us live from Philadelphia and Los Angeles, respectively, plus classic trivia question of the week, all coming up in a half hour ahead after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, and tunein.com, together reaching over 60 million listeners around the world every month and growing. With a very interesting musical experience, check out the Hilltop Radio Show tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, the Hilltop Radio Show only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best of BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to part two of Tomorrow Be Televised, night edition coming your way this Monday afternoon. Simon Applebaum with you live from Nueva York, 82 degrees at the top of the hour. Welcome to those just joining us at the bottom of the hour. More great guests coming your way in the 60 minutes ahead. And we invite you to be part of the program. So give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. And coming up later this half hour, our classic trivia question of the week. We're in our second week of the current question, and if you get it right, you can win a Watermark Paris pen and case. A Waterman, I should say, Paris pen and case that's coming your way before the top of the hour. Back in September of 2013, TNT started a series that was very unusual for its network. It was called Cold Justice. It was overseen by Dick Wolf, of course, the creator of the Law & Order series, as well as the FBI series, Chicago series, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was all about the exploits of a prosecutor and investigator, Kelly Ziegler, who was trying to open up cold cases around the country and find justice for them. The show ran 3 seasons on TNT and then went to Oxygen. It's been on there since 2017. And season number 6 started this past Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Joining us live from 2 different locations on opposite ends of the U.S. of A. are the current key executive producer of the series. First, from Philadelphia, Ashley Grabo-Stell. Ashley, welcome in.
Thank you so much for having us.
It is a pleasure. And from Los Angeles, also an EP, Scott Patch. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us. Glad to be here.
It is a pleasure. Scott, actually, I'll start with you. Why has Cold Justice turned out to be the long-running success it is?
I think that it is, there's nothing like it that has ever existed or existing today where you are getting a chance to follow along as real investigators and real prosecutors work to solve real cases. And I think that people are really fascinated with the evolution of a case and ultimately, you know, finding resolution at the end. And I think that people also are really drawn in by Kelly's passion and enthusiasm and authenticity. And that I really think that's why people love the show.
Scott, anything you want to add on that?
No, I think she nailed it. There's really no other show on TV that does it. It's a really hard show to do because these are all real cases that are unsolved. But Kelly is like the best at what she does, and she's as compassionate with victims' families as she is like tough on crime. I think she's addictive to watch, and I think the investigations are really captivating as to watch them unfold real time.
When we first covered this program back in 2013 for TNT, on TNT, Kelly was on our program, and there was no question when you interviewed you about her commitment to getting this job done, to getting these cold cases, some of whom had been in play or not in play for decades, if you will, and finally bringing them to closure for the people involved, for the cities, the investigators involved. How has Kelly's approach to these cases evolved over the course of this, almost a decade now since she's been doing Cold Justice?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, I think that Scott would actually be a better person to ask because he's been on the show since day one, because I've been on the show since 2017, and I just see an unwavering commitment. When she wakes up every single morning, this is what she focuses on. When she goes to bed every single night, this is what she focuses on. And so I think she's really steadfast in her approach, and with all of her experience in the DA's office and prosecuting cases, I think she was already an expert when she came and, you know, when she created this show. So, you know, that's my answer. But Scott, what do you think?
As far as like how her attitude has changed as the show's gone on, I think, you know, she was an incredibly successful prosecutor with the Houston DA's office. And she was known for that. And I think when she started the show, it was very similar to what she had done in her career, but also a little bit of a different beast, traveling the country, working with local law and helping them on their cases. And I think over the course of the last 7 or 8 years as the show has been on, I have a feeling that, and I don't know, but just her confidence has grown with her ability to be so flexible and to jump in with so many different law enforcement agencies and things. No, don't get me wrong. She was always confident. I could always do it. But I have a feeling that over 8 years, she's done this version of her career for quite a bit. And I imagine she's just excited with all the success that the show has had. And then it's really possible to go in and help and solve these cases and give local law the resources that they're lacking. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I tried.
good try, Scott. And given that you've been aboard the program from the start, what has Dick Wolf's contribution been to this series?
Well,
how does his brand of storytelling, which has worked so well for now more than 2 decades with law and order programs, now with FBI and Chicago, how is his approach to things, how does it how does it impact what you and Ashley do to pull Cole Justice off?
Well, he was obviously instrumental in creating the show. He helped create the show with Kelly. And I think Dick's brand, obviously he's known for crime, but he's also known for really wonderful characters and really wonderful people. And not to call Kelly a character, she is a real person. But I feel like, if anything, there's a real human element to the show. Kelly is really compassionate, and I feel like Dick's influence is felt in how strong of a personality and how talented she is as she goes about solving these cases in a unique way. You know, she's the master of circumstantial evidence cases. Many of these police forces haven't really put together cases like that before, and I think her expertise and her compassion and who she is as a person, I think that that shows in Dick Wolf's, whatever you call it, in all his shows, I think is really important. There's crime and there's a story there and there's a procedural there, but the characters and the people are also just as important.
Ashley, for those who didn't see the first episode, which is subtitled Holiday Homicide, and I did see the first episode, it just came across as a humdinger. This is like, it felt like you had a classic murder case with a classic like Perry Mason or Murder, She Wrote, you know, set of, or Ellery Queen set of possible suspects. For those who didn't see it, I'll just get the ticker down. This is about the head of a tow truck operator who gets executed sort of organized crime style, three bullets in the head, and it seems like every member of the family is a suspect. What was it like to have this case be the season opener?
Well, what's great about, you know, this case, but also every case that we work, is we don't know what is going to happen. You know, it's so different than any other television that you can produce, because as a producer, your natural instinct is to really try to control every element of what you're putting on television. And with this show, you are just as surprised and, you know, engaged in the process as the viewers are, because we have no idea what's going to happen. So, you know, every case that we are able to work is a unique and special case. And it's just such a, I guess for lack of a better term, a unique experience to not really know how your episode is going to turn out when you're walking into it.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, I understand that this, you know, as this episode went forward, there was a real web involved here. It wasn't just like all these people could be guilty one way or the other, but there was also domestic violence was a possibility here, infidelity, you know, crazy family matters, and even the possibility of a contract out for the killer.
Yeah, this was a pretty complicated one for a lot of different reasons, and those are interesting and compelling to put together, and it's tricky. Obviously, we have a team of lawyers who help us on the show figure out what we can say and we can't say on television, help us navigate. It's another difficulty of putting the show on the air, but there were a lot of suspects. There were a lot of possibilities, and it's things that they have. Every road, they are thorough, and they go down, and they explore. And especially with cases that have been around for, this one was since 2003, cases that have been around that long or longer, there are so many rumors and so many things that they need to go through. And this one especially had its fair share because there was the possibility of family involved as well as outside people. So it was very complicated, which did make it very interesting. And like Ashley said, also unique. We don't have very many cases that have this much of a web of possible suspects and motives.
Cold Justice latest season is now running on Oxygen Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. And the first episode of the new season premiered this past weekend, second episode this coming weekend. And we've got the two key executive producers on the series joining us from opposite ends of the U.S. of A. Ashley Graben Steele from, or Stell from Philadelphia, Scott Patch from Los Angeles. They're both with us this half hour. We connected them right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New York in New York, where it is now 82 degrees at the top of the hour. If a question or comment for both of our guests, don't be shy. Ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Avery153 just got into the room. Thank you for coming in. So put your question in the room or comment or give us that call. Sooner you do, sooner we address it. Remember, this is the first of three episodes we're doing this week. Coming up on Wednesday, we'll have the host of the new Peacock series, Tokyo Live. It'll be one of several new series, multi-hour series, covering live, the 2021 Summer Olympics from Tokyo. Matt Isman will be with us. He is the anchor person for Tokyo Live, which will begin next weekend, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Also, speaking of sports, one of our favorite people covering the world of sports television and sports in general, from the Queen's Chronicle, columnist Lloyd Carroll will be with us. We'll talk to him about, the Olympics on television, how will it do? We'll talk about the career of Marv Albert. We may even get to a very controversial Yes Network advertising campaign and maybe even some Emmy talk. Primetime Emmy nominations come out tomorrow. It's all coming up Wednesday. Read the Meets the New Pacific right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Ashley, on average, how does Kelly and her team of investigators, how do they decide what cases they will handle? And once they decide we're doing this case, how much time do they spend on it? You really concentrate.
That's a really great question. Like I said, I've been on the show since 2017, and there are cases that we are still developing that I started working on back then. It really is a collaboration between Kelly and the local law enforcement agency to determine, you know, what is in the best interest of the case. Is it in the best interest of the case for Cole Justice to assist? And where can we best use our resources? And that is really how the cases are chosen. It's always, always about the case and what is best for the case, and are we going to be able to help them get a resolution? And they spend, I mean, they can spend months. And like I said, you know, sometimes we spend years working to develop a case to be able to assist.
Mm-hmm. Scott, when you find these cases, do they tend to be mostly like the case on Saturday, Family Matters? Or do you find the cases are more widespread? Do you have cases like, for example, this person was, you know, random shooting or random murder? She didn't know what the, you know, coming out of the field, out of left field, or a case where it's a workplace situation or a business or a corporate crime?
We've had a few of those, and Ashley can speak to these a little bit better than I can. But I feel like in assessing what might be solvable and can be helped the most by Kelly and her team, if there was a random shooting at a gas station or something and there are no suspects and it's a stranger that committed the crime, those are normally not the types of crimes that Cold Justice investigates, because those, I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't know if they have the leads to really go down those roads. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ashley, but I feel like most of the cases we have, it's not necessarily a family member, but most of the suspects are primarily people that were in a close circle with the victim, and it makes it a little bit easier to figure out what their possible motives and what have witnesses that are able to speak to that. Am I right, Ashley?
Yeah, and to just jump in, I think Scott mentioned this earlier. Kelly is the master of solving cases with circumstantial evidence, and typically, cases that are random shootings or, you know, a gas station robbery, you're not going to have much circumstantial evidence. You're going to solve it with, you know, eyewitness testimony from people that were there at the scene, or fingerprints, or, closed circuit video or whatever that may be. And so that isn't as much. And Kelly could absolutely solve those cases, no problem. But, you know, her expertise comes in the more difficult cases that are building circumstantial evidence and being able to prosecute based on that. So that really is more likely. But we do a wide range of crimes. You know, it doesn't matter who the killer is or who the victim is. You know, we're going to try and solve it. You know, it could be a lover's quarrel. It could be, you know, a grandmother, grandson. It could be, business partners. It really doesn't matter who it is. If we are able to assist, we're going to try.
Mm-hmm. Avery 153 in our chat room has a question for both of you. What is it like for you as producers to tell the story of these cases and at the same time to be as sensitive as possible to the victims of these crimes?
Well, Scott, do you want to take that one?
Sure. As far as the logistics go, I work primarily on the post side with all the editors and the story producers in taking the 100 plus hours of footage that we have and crafting it down into the 43 minutes that you see on TV. And so I can tell you it's a challenge just to whittle down a really thorough murder investigation down to 43 minutes. So that's the logistical challenge of all of it. And we also have to be sensitive that these are all real people, and you don't want to – we try not to be too salacious with anything or gratuitous with it. We don't show – obviously, we work hand-in-hand with the police, so we have all the crime scene photos and we have all that, and we try to keep in mind that the victims' families are going to be watching this program. And so it's for everybody to watch, but we try to be very sensitive to these are real people. These are real victims and victims' families. And a lot of the information we share on the show, they may not know. So you do have to keep it in mind, and you have to be, you have to be a producer, but you also have to be a human with a heart, because Kelly is that way. And it kind of dictates the way the whole show goes. If that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. And Ashley, when you're dealing, I guess, in the actual production, the actual investigation process, how do you answer that question of being sensitive to victims?
So I can tell you my part of the process comes before actual production. So we really work to find these cases. But I do know that our production team is extremely sensitive to the fact that these families have been through so much, and they have had so much pain and very little peace, since their family member passed away. So the way we handle it is we really don't even have any conversations with the family until we know that we 100% are able to help and we are on our way, because we never want to cause them any more pain or get their hopes up if we aren't able to assist. So that's where the process begins. We're always thinking about the family and, how is this going to impact them? And that's carried throughout production, from the first time that we basically, touch them and reach out to them to let them know this, we want to help. This is what we're doing. Are you okay with that? Do you want to be a part of this process? And we kind of, hold their hand for, lack of a better term, throughout the entire process to make sure that they're taken care of. Because none of us could ever imagine what it's like being them or what they've gone through.
And I know
over
Kelly
the
and
eight
some of
years,
the
Cold Justice is on the air, first on TNT and now on Austin. You should know that there have been 49 arrests made in these cold cases that have investigated and 21 convictions so far. The new season of Cold Justice started this past Saturday night, 18 Eastern Time and Pacific Time on Oxygen. We've got the two key executive producers on the program for us. And for you, Ashley Graybow-Stell and Scott Patch. Ashley from Philadelphia, Scott from Los Angeles, and all of you, wherever you are, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised this half hour. Simon, with you live from New York. And if you have a question or comment before we wrap things up with our pair, give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04. But every 153 gave us a question a moment ago. We've got another one for you. We'll get to that shortly. But coming up before the top of the hour, classic trivia question of the week. Stay tuned. Get your thinking caps on, because if you can give us the correct answer ASAP, you'll win a Waterman Paris pen and case. So stay tuned before the top of the hour. We're going to give that question to you. And we'd love to have a winner, which will be our fourth winner in 6 weeks. So Avery 153 has got another question from our chat room, and it's for both of you. How fulfilling a show is this to work on, because you are dealing one way or another with real people, dealing with cases that they would like to get closure on?
I've never had as fulfilling of a job as this. I mean, television is really, really fun to work in, and I've worked on some really fun programs, but knowing why we're coming to work every day and why we work so hard, there's nothing better, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I jumped to answer this question as well as Ashley at the same time is because this is really like the easiest question to answer ever. We've all worked on lots of TV shows, but there's just nothing like this. It really is helping family members who have suffered for years. It's really such a satisfying feeling to even be such a small part of the machine that is Cold Justice and is really helping these people get the justice that they deserve. I don't know. I can't speak highly enough at how great it is and how, we've had lots of people work on the show through the years and they all share the same sentiment. It's just so rewarding to be even a small part of such a successful show.
And again, thank you to Avery153 for your questions. Really appreciate it being in our chat room. Stay tuned and keep listening. We'd love to have you aboard. I had a chance to see your Facebook page earlier today, and about 300,000 people that are following the series on Facebook. And one of the things, the concerns that they have, or one of the points they raise is this. Have you ever thought about doing an episode where you just summarize where cases are at? Or let's say at the end of a season, you do like, here's where we stand with these cases, whether they have been closed or whether they are still ongoing or whether, you know, you've come up with, sorry, the cold case is going to stay cold. Has there any thought about doing a end-of-year episode or end-of-season episode which sort of, you know, brings people up to date on cases?
We have definitely spoken about it lots of times before, and I know that we are eager to do it, and we know that fans would love that as well. Television moves much, much faster than the legal system, and a lot of times I think even if a whole season has gone by, some of those first cases you saw still haven't, you know, a plea deal hasn't been arranged, they haven't gone to trial, people are still in custody. And so I feel like there are updates, and I do think that we will be doing an update kind of recap show in the future, but I think part of the challenge is I don't think they're as speedy as the fans would like. Ashley?
You said it all. Yeah, that's exactly
right. Okay, great.
Yeah, no, that's it. And we would love to. Mm-hmm. We talk about it all the time, and when the time is right, you know, when we can give, you know, give the fans what they're looking for sure.
At one point, there was a spinoff show called Sex Crimes, sort of your law, your cold assist SVU. Is there any talk about doing another spinoff or bring Sex Crimes back?
Not that I know of, but that doesn't mean very much. I just haven't been in those conversations. I don't know if, Ashley, you have.
Yeah, I don't think we're the right people to ask that question, unfortunately. That would be really interesting, definitely. We know there's lots of victims out there.
Well, Dick Wolf, you are welcome to come on this program anytime. I've wanted to have Dick Wolf on this program for years, and given all the things he is doing, he's doing some new shows, including his first for Amazon's IMDb.tv service, the ad support service, half-hour procedural series. Dick, anytime you'd like to come on our program, we'll do an hour, hour and a half with you, and we'll ask the question about whether you might do spinoffs and cold justice. So for both of you, what are some of the cases that we can look forward to seeing in the weeks ahead?
Well, there's a few more coming up every Saturday. And let's see, the next case is Stephen Phelps, which is also in Texas, which is a wonderful case. It's so hard to talk about them. They're all so unique and so different, it's hard to kind of group them all together. But I can tell you that there are, for people who care about this type of thing, there are more arrests coming. There are wonderful families that we get to meet and get to try to help, and there are wonderful law enforcement officers who get our help, and the cases are all just great. I don't know. It's so hard to pick out individual things, but it's great. It's a really good season that's off to a really good start, and it's going to continue, and I hope that people continue to watch.
Incidentally, do these cold justice cases tend to be grouped in particular states or particular areas of the country, whether Southeast, East, New England, Midwest, and so on and so forth? I know there have been a number of cases over the years from Texas, including the one that was on Saturday night.
No, that's a really interesting question. And the answer is no. We go wherever we are needed and wanted and where it's in the best interest of the case. We work with law enforcement agencies all across the country. And it just so happens, you know, Kelly's from Texas and has a lot of relationships there. And we get a lot of calls from those agencies asking us to look at cases. So it's also a very big state. So, but yeah, we work all over, and we have to be invited by the local law enforcement agency to come in and work the case alongside them and assist them. We don't work any cases where we're not invited. We need the entire case, access to the entire case file so that Kelly and her team can make a proper assessment of it. So we, like I said, we'll go wherever it is in the best interest of the case. Doesn't matter where it is.
Episode 2 of the new season of Cold Justice coming your way this Saturday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on Oxygen, executive produced by Dick Wolf, along with the two people that you heard over this last half hour or so. And for more details about the program online and the rest of Oxygen's schedule of virtual programming, go to www.oxygen.com. It's www.oxygen.com. Cold Justice, new season, now second episode, coming your way Saturday, 8 p.m. Pacific Time on Oxygen, available on most. And by the way, don't forget to check locations to the Oxygen cable, where Oxygen is available in your area, on cable and Saturday. Once again, Cold Justice, Saturday night, 8 p.m. Pacific Time on Oxygen. Check load listings for where it's at on cable and satellite. And again, for more details, oxygen.com. Ashley, Grave Ostell, Scott Patch, thank you both very much for coming on. Give our best to Kelly. It was a pleasure to have her on this program when Cold Justice started 8 years ago. And wish her and investigators and everybody involved with them the very, very best. And hopefully more and more of these cases will not only be brought to justice, but be brought to justice with closure for everybody involved. And again, great pleasure to have you both on.
Thank you so much for having us. Pleasure.
You're welcome, Ashley and Scott. Take care. Again, enjoy the week.
You too. Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Ashley Grove-Ostell, Scott Patch, joining us live from Philadelphia and Los Angeles, respectively. More tomorrow will be televised coming away with classic trivia question of the week. First, some words from the fine folks at our sponsor, Audible.com. Are you interested in something to hear that's just perfect for summer? Well, how about this audiobook, The Paper Palace, by Miranda Conley Heller. It is a summertime story that will be unforgettable. And you can check it out right now as your wonderful audiobook to test on a one-month trial run with Audible.com. Now, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. There's over 200,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iRadio Podcast Network, Verbal, etc. Don't forget, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook, 1 month trial of the service, great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com, and while it lasts, health and wellness information. And by the way, if you are an Amazon Prime member already, make that two audiobooks you can get for your trial, including one from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. We're talking about original audio podcast series and productions, best of off-Broadway and regional theater, great one-woman and one-man performances, too. That's all available for you when you go to audibletrial.com/teller. Remember, it's a great gift for you or anyone you love any time of the year. Now time for our classic trivia question of the week. And in the next few minutes, you can become our fourth winner over the past 6 weeks. And if you are the person who becomes our next winner, you will receive a Waterman Paris pen and matching case. Here's the question. Dexter's Lab, or Laboratory, was the first Cartoon Network original half-hour tune back in 1996. The following year, the second one happened. What was the second? Dexter's Laboratory was the first Cartoon Network original half-hour tune series back in 1996. Name the second that appeared in 1997. If you're the first with the correct answer, you win. So if you have that answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from. First with the correct answer, you win. If we don't get a winner by the end today, we'll post the question tomorrow on Facebook and on Twitter. Facebook at Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, go ahead and play in. Nothing to lose, everything to gain, and all the very best. And if you haven't heard, we are now in our second week of offering our program on our brand new website, tomorrowwillbetelevised.podsite, podsite.io. That's tomorrowwillbetelevised.podsite, podsite.io. Most recent episode, top of the screen, click and you get it. Recent episode, the bottom of the screen, click and you get them, one at a time. And you can also leave a comment, and we'll respond to it. So check it out. Week number two of our brand new website, Tomorrow We Televise, at podsite.io. That's .podsite, P-O-D-S-I-T-E.io. Coming up next, I think we're going to go across the pond, and we're going to speak with the producer director of the brand new PBS miniseries, Icon, Music Through the Lens. Dick Carruthers, producer director, joins me after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com. Together, reaching over 60 million listeners around the world every month and growing. One of B-Charts most popular programs comes your way tomorrow afternoon. It's the B-Side. Music and more tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific. That's 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific. The B-Side, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best B-Chart 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final half hour of Tomorrow Televised, and one of those you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Abbott with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard. If you have a question or comment for our guest ahead, give us a ring at 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you are, Texas, across the country, or around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio. Chat room is open. It's been a little busy today. We like that. So if you have a question or comment, not shy, very shy about the phone, use the chat room. It's open right now, SimonApple04, and you'll find it at the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And again, while the promo is on the air, you can connect with others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk speaker tune-in screen. Follow the instructions. Other people can be live with you. This Friday, PBS is presenting a very unusual mini-series that approaches music from a very unusual standpoint. The pictures of the artists in action, and in private too. It's called Icon, Music Through the Lens. And joining us live to talk about it, and I believe he is joining us live from Great Britain, is the producer-director of the series.
Hey.
You may know him from an excellent movie made about Led Zeppelin some years ago called Celebration Day. He is also a very popular music video director, and I believe he's done some PBS work before. Joining us live, Dick Carruthers. Dick, thank you for coming on.
Hey, Simon, can you hear me okay?
We can hear you loud and clear. Where are you calling from today, which I believe is evening your time right now?
It is evening my time, and I don't want to make a big thing of it, but we just got flooded. So I'm speaking to you from having been mopping on my hands and knees for the last couple of hours, thinking I got to get this finished by 9 p.m.
Absolutely got that, and we hope that the flood eases as the time goes forward. Dick, tell us about how you got involved with this PBS project.
Well, I'm delighted that PBS are carrying the six-part series. They weren't initially in on the commission of it. It actually goes back about 10 years to when the photographer Gerard Mankiewicz and I first sort of just came up with a very simple idea of let's make – his idea was there's never been a great documentary made on music photographers and music photography as an art form. So then took about 8 years for us to get a pilot made and get the finances together. And then the last 2 years, we've been flat out in production. And so big shout out to FilmRise from your New York there, who came up with some financing and some creative steering. And it got made. And we're delighted that PBS are going to be airing it because it's going to get a big audience that it truly deserves.
Mm-hmm. As you were looking at putting this together, Dick, what conclusion did you come to about how do you make a program about still photography, albeit still photography about the greatest musicians of our generation, past generations, how do you make it visually work for television?
Well, that was indeed one of the challenges. You know, it's like what Frank Zappa said. It's like tap dancing about architecture to a point, isn't it? But at least on TV, we can show the photographs. We're very aware that there's a limit to a 16:9 frame to show photographs, and we didn't want to overcomplicate and zoom in on stuff or do rostrum moves as a lot of photography was presented. It was quite important to us to present the photographs, and if they're as good as we're saying they are, if they've got as much to be read into them, if they're going to hit you as viscerally and as emotionally as we say they will, then it should work, right? We should just be able to show them. But the simple elements, the simple elements of what Icon is put together out of is good rock and roll stories, good music stories, the photographs themselves, music, inevitably, and peppering that with some live music and some famous tracks. But if those things are blended well together, it's like an Italian salad, I guess. If three or four simple ingredients, but if they're done in just the right measures, it's beautiful. And presenting photographs whilst they're being talked about, it's like, you know, I love when I go to a museum having those audio things, you know, the headphones and having those, because I can walk around and look at the pictures. But when somebody's pointing stuff out or telling me the story or the history of it, it's that much more accessible and it's that much more exciting. And Icon works on that level, that it presents these beautiful photographs, these brilliant, exciting, sexy, provocative, strange, bizarre, you know, all of the above photographs, but with the stories of how and when they were taken by the people themselves. In some cases, we've got the artist talking about the photo shoot as well as the photographer that took the photographs. So I think the answer to your question is just great stories with the visuals, and it works.
For you and your production team, Dick, what was the bigger challenge, finding the pictures and determining which ones you use and how you arrange them, or finding the photographers who made the pictures and encouraging them to explain their art on camera?
Well, the former, Simon. We were blessed with far too much material. We reached out to many, many photographers. We couldn't reach everybody, of course, but we did reach a great number. I think we did 128 interviews for this series, of which the photographers were 60, 70 of those, and a lot of artists and managers and so on as well. And so all of them, two or one, there wasn't a lame interview amongst them, and a lot of the interviews went to 2.5 hours and more because there was just so many great stories to tell. Once you've got that rapport, once you've got that trust of the people, because you know, these are people who've devoted their lives to being music photographers, right? And so we present ourselves saying, well, we're going to make a whole TV series about your chosen art form. And we want to present you and your work in the best possible light. And which is true, you know, there's no kind of some photographers are quite cautious about their work, you know, because there's a lot of copyright issues, there's a lot of digital theft, you know, all of which are themes that we explore in the series. But we got everybody to trust us because everybody knew Gerrit Mankiewicz. I myself, you know, we come from a credible background, put it that way. And so we got everybody's trust. So we ended up with hundreds of hours, literally hundreds of hours of fantastic stories and the photos that went with them, because the photographers obviously, again, were very generous with us and said, use that. We did pay for them. I would like to state that for anybody who's probably thinking, did they get them for free? We didn't. We made sure, although we didn't pay sort of top dollar book cover sort of prices, we wanted to pay everybody for the use of their photos. So we were going to pay, and so we had too much material. So then the problem became a good problem, which was how to sift through all of these great stories and these great interviews and get the stories that connected together into a narrative. I don't know if you've had the chance to watch any of the programs, Simon, but I would like to think that we did achieve that mission where we chose not the most famous photographs, although there's plenty of those in there, but the ones that had the most exciting or funny stories that connected, you know, the ones that were, the connections are about love or about luck or about surprise or about, you know, a photo that changes the trajectory of a musician's career, or the very first photograph that came up a lot, you know, the very early photographs of Madonna, the very early photographs of Elton John, you know, those. David Bowie comes up a lot as well. You know, those are really, really important because there isn't anything before that. People want to know what these artists look like when they're hearing their tracks on the radio.
You're hearing producer director Dick Carruthers from the new PBS series Icon, Music Through the Lens. The six-part series begins this Friday for many PBS stations at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. And as always, when we talk about a public television series, we have to tell you, you got to watch out for two things. One, the PBS station in your area that is running the show, and secondly, when it runs. Many PBS stations will run the show Friday at the 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific time period. Others will run the show later in the day or earlier. Some will run it during the weekend, and some will do a second repeat telecast also during the weekend or the following week. So you got to really watch the listings and make sure you know what is going on with the station in your area. And Dick Carruthers joins us live from Europe. This half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon, I'm with you live from the other side of the Atlantic, Nueva York, 80 degrees at the top of the hour. If you have a question or comment for Dick, make the call go, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. We have two more episodes of our program coming your way Wednesday and Friday at this very hour. Do not miss our show Friday, the first half hour, because we're going to showcase a breaking story that we expect to be breaking on Thursday involving a big venture in interactive television. It's from a company that we have covered before on this program that is about to, we think, make a major, major deal. And in addition, They have hired an advisor who happens to be one of the key promo executives around in television. We'll have that person on, plus the head of the company that this breaking news will be affecting. So be sure to join us Friday for our first half hour, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. I promise you it will be a very exciting and illuminating half hour, especially if you're into the growing world of interactive television. Dick, it's very clear that in the 1980s, MTV and services like it on cable changed the whole way we see music on television with the music video. Is it fair to say that with the rise of stars like Michael Jackson and Madonna and Culture Club and other groups and solo performers in the 1980s, that this was also a golden age, a turning point age for music photography?
That's a very good question. I mean, there was a paradigm shift when MTV came along. I think answering on the hoof, I think MTV, there would have been a parallel because MTV excited everybody visually, you know, and the pop promo became this enormous currency where you could get to see these artists and also they could add a sort of a personality and a story to their songs and so on. So it was great. I loved it. I was part of it to a degree. But I think so then that would have interested fans more in the visual side of their artists. Prior to that, again, as we delve into in episode 3 of Icon, which is all devoted to album cover art, before then, other than a magazine, which is episode 4, the fan would have just been presented with the cover image of an album, you know, way before CDs, or if you bought the music press, if you had Cream or Rolling Stone and so on. So the massive amount of visual information that was out there sort of creates a currency for it. So inevitably, I think people would have been absorbing more music photographs. I mean, a point that we also make in episode 5 is that you yourself, Simon, everyone, all of your listeners, they're all collectors of music photography without even realizing it, right? Just by virtue of the fact of having CDs and albums, depending on how old they are, they're already collectors. If they ever got music magazines, you can bet that they cut something out and stuck it on their wall, right? So it was an art form that was hidden in plain sight. And I think the MTV and the explosion of interest in that can only have just pushed it further. There were certainly more magazines that came out. I should perhaps explain that again for you and your listeners, if you haven't had a chance to preview it, that the 6 episodes of Icon are divided up into it's like episode 1 is an introduction and all about studio portrait photography. So we go back as far as that famous portrait of Robert Johnson in the Hooks Brothers studios in about 1920 or 30 something, right the way through to the modern day and Billie Eilish. And in episode 2, we focus on live and on-stage and off-stage photography. In episode 3, we look at album covers. In episode 4, we look at magazines and magazine covers. Episode 5, suddenly you're thinking, well, what else can we talk about now? It's about coffee table books and art exhibitions and fine art photography and the fact that some photographs go for $50,000, and there's one particular set of photographs that will cost you over $1 million if you want one of the 6 existing sets. I'll give you definite 2 points if you can guess which that one is. And episode 6 looks forward to the future and looks at Instagram and how music photography is consumed now. So we come at the same subject from 6 different angles, and it's quite unrelentingly fast-paced and interesting and all cut to great music. There's 40 of the best tracks that you will love, plus God knows how many tracks we had composed for the series. So there you go. There's my elevator pitch for you.
Mm-hmm. When you talked to the photographers themselves, I saw some of the clips of the interviews. I guess there was a very interesting level of enthusiasm they showed, and I'm wondering if that came from the fact that they sensed that for the very first time in their lives, they're being recognized for their work. It's like, eureka, at long last, my work is being recognized for a project for a general audience as opposed to a project for the music crowd.
You're absolutely right. There is, and you're right to detect that. I think it's not from a place of anger. It's from a place of justice at last. You know, I think we got that from a lot of our interviewees. Because they know that they're already signed up to the argument that this is a truly great calling. It's a fascinating and beautiful art form in itself. And if there is any kind of irony or injustice out there in the world, is that music photography hitherto hasn't been quite appreciated as much as fine art photography or portraiture, and that is changing. And that's something we delve into mostly in episode 5, as I said, where we talk about where we interview gallery owners and about auctions and the crazy prices that some of these limited edition photographs will go for now. But yeah, depending on the status of the photographer, you know, we tried very hard to get a huge spread of male and female, young and old, of every diversity and ethnicity, so that everybody could be represented as much as possible, and to reflect that. The more established photographers or even household names probably have had the recognition and were probably opposite. They were probably thinking, well, you know, am I going to be appearing in this series enough? Whereas some of the younger photographers were just thrilled to be interviewed. And I think 201, every photographer we interviewed was delighted to be involved, flattered even, and wanted to be part of it. Again, that's that trust thing. And trust itself is an absolutely central theme throughout all 6 episodes of Icon, because what you get from an artist when you're a photographer is largely reliant on the trust. If they give you something, so many of the photographers talk about it, will give you something. They can withhold it and you've got nothing. There's a terrific story by Chris Floyd about how he spent all day waiting for Paul McCartney, and then in the end they agreed to come back on Monday. And even then, he wasn't getting anything. And then there was this moment, and some things were said, and he got it. I mean, there's many stories like that where there is just this moment, and they capture it. And of course, it's knowing when to click the shutter, and knowing how to light, and knowing which lens to have on. All of those things combined. It's great. I mean, I could go and watch it again tomorrow.
Icon, Music Through the Lens. It's the new 6-part PBS miniseries, and it premieres this Friday night, 9:10 Eastern Pacific Time, on your local public television station. And again, check your local listings for the PBS station in your area. Sometimes more than one that will run the program, and when they will run it. Some will run it at that Friday hour, some earlier, some later, some during the weekend, some with a second replay either during that weekend or later on the following week. We've got producer-director Dick Carruthers joining us live from Europe this half hour on Smart Be Televised. And if you have a question or comment for him in our remaining moments on the air, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Dick, in recent years, there seems to be more of an appreciation with cinematographers in film, people who beforehand were very much unknown but really created a great vocabulary for cinema. James Wong Howe, Greg Tolan, in more recent years, Conrad Hall, Caleb Deschanel, Robert Burks, who for many years was Alfred Hitchcock's cinematographer in the 1950s and 60s on his greatest movies and so forth. Is there anyone that you were able to get for your series that is sort of the James Wong Howe or Caleb Deschanel, if you will, of music photography that you were very excited to get and really got a great interview from?
The answer is absolutely yes. Unfortunately, some of the great pioneers of music photography are no longer with us, and we just missed them. I think Gerard and I were talking about this series when Alfred Wertheimer, who did all of those great photos of Elvis, was still alive. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get Albert. And Terry O'Neill is a very well-known photographer, not just for music. You might know Terry's famous one of Faye Dunaway with her Oscar the morning after, sat by the pool at the Sunset Marquee. That's one of Terry's. or ones of Frank Sinatra. But Terry also took some brilliant, absolutely legendary pictures, like the David Bowie Diamond Dogs album cover. And Terry was very ill, but very graciously gave us an interview. He was ill, but he really wanted to do it, and he gave us a fantastic and was very generous in his interview, and was very generous with letting us use his priceless images. You know, these photographers don't just do that to anybody who asks, you know. So we were delighted to get Terry, and he did actually pass away while we were in post-production. And so because a lot of episode 6 has got Terry in it, I put a little in memoriam to him in the credits in episode 6. I thought that was a good and respectful thing to do. So definitely, you know, we got Terry O'Neill and a couple of younger than Terry, I should be careful what I say. Some of the did we get some legends? Yes, we absolutely did. I mean, legends that gave us that gave us so many of the great photos of the 70s, the pioneers from it. Henry Diltz is one. Henry Diltz that worked with the Mamas and the Papas, and he does a great story about the Jacksons, very young Michael Jackson, that he took photographs of. The Doors, Henry did a lot with The Doors. You know what? Henry did a lot with everybody. And again, his was a terrific interview. We could have made a whole hour and a half documentary out of just Terry's Henry's stories. So it was great that Henry would come on board. And Gerrard himself, obviously, is something of a legend. He took the immortal portraits of Jimi Hendrix and the Stones on tour in 65. Neil Preston is a bit of a legend, toured with Led Zeppelin, The Who. His photographs are just stunning. I mean, he features a lot in episode 2. Bob Gruen is another legend who lives in New York. You probably know him. You certainly know his John Lennon in a New York vest image as one of his go-to images. But, you know, Bob had a lot more to give than just his famous images. You know, terrific stories of The Clash and of Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious. Fantastic pictures. And so Bob features quite a lot. There's a lady called Jill Firmanowski, who's a friend of, because I worked with Oasis and still working with them right now, as it happens, for 26 years later. Jill's been along with the ride with Oasis all along the way, but has also got beautiful pictures of Charlie Watts, beautiful pictures of Joy Division.
We have Rick Webb from Philadelphia on the line, and we're running short of time. Dick, Rick, go ahead with your question.
Well, first, real quick, I just wanted to say I'm so happy to see that this is coming on TBS. I just bought some anamorphic lenses just to film music shows as they're coming on again in America. So I'm very happy to see this and do my homework with your show. So I'm just quickly wondering whether you had any trouble getting certain photographs for your documentary, especially I've heard Jimi Hendrix photographs are really expensive and really difficult to get rights to.
We were extremely lucky, and thank you for your question, Rick. The answer is we did what you call a most favored nations, which was if you try and put a value on a photograph and include it, you know, it's impossible if we'd have paid a different amount of photograph. So what we attempted and achieved was to say to every photographer and every agency, we're going to do a set rate for a photograph to include in the show. And it's the same for Terry O'Neill. It's the same for Gerrard's own Jimi Hendrix pictures. There's some terrific Hendrix pictures that Baron Woolman took that feature heavily in that. You're going to really love this, Rick. There's great stories from how could I not mention Baron Woolman before? Again, Baron himself passed away, God rest his soul, in the post-production period. But terrific interview with Baron. We went and visited him in Santa Fe, and he told us stories that would make your hair stand on end about the 60s and Woodstock and everything. Terrific, terrific guy. Anyway, that was the answer, Rick. We played with a straight bat, as we say over here in cricket. We put everybody at the same value. Now, if you wanted to include a picture of Jimi Hendrix in a movie, then, yeah, the photographer is probably going to say, well, you know, you're going to have to give me $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. But we couldn't do that, but we were coming from an honest perspective where we were saying we want to include it because it's a great piece of art, and we want to review and acknowledge this, not to rip you off or make money or sort of, you know, use it to sort of bolster something else or sell soap suds or something. You know, we want to talk about why this is a great photograph, and because that was the true trajectory of our series, everybody was on board. I mean, there was probably a few that somebody said, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that for less than $5,000. And we're like, okay, it's a shame. But you know what? There are 3,000 photographs featured in the 6 episodes. As I said before, 128 interviews, 3,000 photographs, hundreds of bits of music. So if we really did like war with something, we would let it go. I think there was one or two things that I could spring to mind that I just let go because it was just too complicated. But 99 times out of 100 or more, it was like, oh, you can have it. In some cases, it was even they'd waive the fee and say, yeah, go ahead and use it. So there you go.
Rick, I have to interrupt because we are running out of time. Rick Webb from Philadelphia, thank you so much for your question. Again, the program is Icon Music to the Land, 6-part miniseries kicks off this Friday night, 9:10 Pacific time on PBS, including on here in New York on WNET Channel 13, I believe also KCET and SoCal out in Los Angeles. Remember, when you talk about public television, check your local dial to the PBS station in your area, but also when they are running it. Some stations will run the show when it's supposed to run Friday night, others earlier, others later. Some on the weekend, and some will have a replay also later in the weekend or the following week. For more details about the program online, pbs.org. Dick Carruthers, News Director, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on making this project happen, you and your production crew, and hopefully it's going to have a wonderful run here on PBS in the States and hopefully other parts of the world too.
Thank you so much, Simon. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And hang in there with the flood. It will subside. Things will get better days ahead. Dick Carruthers, producer director of Icon Music of the Lens, joining us live from Europe here on Swabby Televised. Thanks to all our guests for making these 90 minutes fly and fly great. We're back with another program coming your way, second of three, less than 48 hours from now on Wednesday. And joining us then will be, from Peacock Tokyo Live, will be anchor person Matt Isman and our good friend for the Queen's Chronicle, sports and TV columnist Lloyd Carroll. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out our podcasts. They're available all over the place, including Apple Podcasts, iRadio Podcast Network, other places too. And don't forget our new website, podsite.io. Remember, you can find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, as well as Twitter. And if you want to email me with a question or comment about the show, it's simonapple04@yahoo.com. We always answer what you have to say because what you say matters. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not those of the Blog Talk Radio distributors of this program. Andy Toad's Blog Talk Radio's general manager, and Jay Sonberg is head of content. Website service is provided by Podsite, the new internet avenue for podcasts. More details, go to podsite.io. Our web coordinator is guitarist Falkus. Swabby Televised brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For all details, it's audibletrial.com/televised. For Swabby Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your Monday. Back on Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. You know where. Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio, Verbal, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and the iRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to now and then, please make it safe. And, of course, make it great. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.